Hey everyone, and welcome to the Scientist Podcast. I hope you're really well. Today I'm talking to a hugely impressive cosmologist and astroparticle physicist, and I have to tell you, I've been looking forward to this immensely. She's working on her PhD at UC Irvine and specializes in dark matter, something I and hopefully you listening are going to learn a little bit about today. With no further ado, I'm pleased to welcome Sophia Nasra. Sophia, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm not bad. It's brilliant to have you on. Before we start, you've just got your first paper published in JCAP. Congrats. How's that all been?
Thanks so much. Yeah, so the way that it works, at least in my field, is that we release our papers on the archive before they're published, and then we submit them to get published. So the real celebration actually happened in June when it was put up on the archive. But, you know, it doesn't really mean as much until it's actually published in the journal. And so that's something that I was working on since undergrad up until grad school. And so it meant a lot. So thank you.
So for some context, how long have you been working on that for?
Almost 4 years.
Whoa. Well, very cool to get it done. You're obviously a big fan of communicating physics to the public. And underlying that is obviously a genuine love for the thing. So what for you is so cool about, I mean, physics, but particularly astroparticle physics?
Everything. For me, what really gets me about physics and the universe is the stuff that we don't understand. And there's so much of it. And so it's the mystery behind it, the fact that we have so much work to do to get to really understanding things and what comes with solving little problems, you know, that brings new physics too. So the excitement with what's to come when the problem is solved also is what gets me. And so the reason why astroparticle physics in particular is because one of the main problems that I chose to work on in my career is dark matter. When we think about dark matter, if it's a particle, then that requires particle physics. But because it's in the universe, we can use cosmology and astrophysics for it. And so it becomes astroparticle physics.
Yeah, that's actually a really nice lead-in, because you've spoken about astroparticle theory as the intersection of astrophysics, particle physics, cosmology, etc. And it's an area that, and I'm quoting here, uses the very big and the very small to solve some of the universe's greatest mysteries. Is the fact that you're trying to solve genuinely massive questions part of the appeal?
Very much. For example, with dark matter, just the fact that there's weird stuff going on alone tells me that there's new physics coming, regardless. It doesn't matter what it turns out to be. We know that new physics is coming, period. Okay. And so what that brings, I can't tell you. But I mean, if we look in the past, new physics has brought huge things to us. I mean, you know, we have light, we have computers, we're able to communicate the way that we are now because of things like this. And so it really gets me excited for what is coming.
Is the idea there that the current physics is unable to explain the solutions to these mysteries, and therefore in trying to answer them, will kind of along for the ride, have to bring in this new wave of physics, which in turn then poses and answers more questions?
Yes, exactly. And so just knowing that we don't have all the answers right now, and what we currently understand isn't capable of explaining those things, already tells me that there's so much coming. And so like that it makes me so excited. That's why I love to do this.
Yeah, so the terms observable universe and unobservable universe get thrown around a fair bit. And most people who aren't even scientists are vaguely familiar with them. As something of an entry-level question, how do we pick up on the existence of an unobservable universe if it is, drumroll, unobservable?
Now, the answer to that is you can't. If we're looking for a signal, you can't, because it's unreachable to us. So the unobservable universe is literally a place we can never contact. We can only know of it theoretically, because light from that part of the universe will not have had enough time to reach us. And so there's never going to be a way for us to know what's there. That's why we call it unobservable, because it's completely unreachable for us. It might as well not exist, because we will never see it. And so that's why we make the distinction. So like with the observable universe, this is the part of the universe that we can actually see. Whereas beyond that, you can't get anything out of it. So we only work on it with theory. And that's it.
And what in the theory has suggested to us that it exists? Is it that we need it to make sense of calculations? Is it that, well, the universe is expanding and it has to be expanding into something? Where did we get to the term unobservable universe to start?
So the reason why we have an unobservable universe is because, well, the universe is expanding at an accelerating rate, which means that objects that are further away from us are getting further and further, but faster with the progression of time. And so eventually these things, even though in the past some things may have been within our observable universe where we could actually see it, they will have been pulled out to a point where we can't see it any longer. And so that's what gives us part of the unobservable universe. another part is just there's something called a particle horizon or a Hubble horizon, which is kind of like as far as we can see. Beyond that, you just can't see. Beyond your particle horizon, anything that is beyond that, you could have never contacted it at all in the history or today. So these things are going to be out of your reach regardless what you do. And so it's kind of just inherently there that there's going to be parts of the universe that you can't see. And that's because of the fact that, you know, we have a finite speed of light and the universe is possibly infinite. I mean, we can say that because it's flat. And so we would never be able to contact all of it for that reason.
Here's a question. My understanding, and it's a very basic understanding of the Big Bang, and we'll get into this in some detail. I've linked the Big Bang to the expanding universe. I have this idea that there was one or two tiny particles and out everything explodes. Hence, the universe's boundaries keep on pushing because of the initial explosion. Am I right to link the Big Bang and the expanding universe?
It's really interesting that you say that, because there's actually something that is literally analogous to what's happening right now, the expansion of the universe, that we think happened in the early universe as well. So like today, dark energy or the cosmological constant is what's causing the universe to expand, which is basically kind of like a field. And so we think that in the early universe, there was something analogous to it called inflation that we can treat the same way in physics and in the physics of it. And so during that time, the universe went from like microscopic to macroscopic in a fraction of a second, like in a tiny fraction of a second. And having inflation, like the reason why it makes sense is because it solves a lot of problems that otherwise wouldn't make sense. Like, for example, we find that the universe is flat. This is really strange because the universe could take on any different value. For example, like there's one critical value that will give you a flat universe. Otherwise, if you're above it, you'll get a positively curved. If you're below it, you'll get a negatively curved. So with that entire range, why did the universe pick exactly that? And so inflation would explain that by saying it doesn't matter what curvature the universe begins with, because it expands so fast, it kind of flattens it out instantly. So you end up with a flat universe because of that. Great. Another thing that we see is that there are like, I think about 300,000 parts of the universe that are actually out of causal contact. Like the lengths between them, there's no way that light could have been able to communicate with any of these parts. But we have a universe that's overall pretty homogeneous in temperature. So how can you explain that? How is the universe so uniform? Like, why would the temperature be the same? It's kind of like sampling, say, all of California and looking at a bunch of houses and seeing them all being at the same temperature, just like that. Unless they talk to each other, that doesn't make sense, you know? And I take this from Barbara Ryan, and she kind of came up with this cool explanation. She wrote an intro to cosmology textbook, which is amazing. It's a really good beginner textbook. And if anybody ever gets it, I really, really recommend you read the footnotes. Just saying, because they're really good. And so with inflation, we start with a universe that's microscopic, in which, okay, everything at that point we can see is in causal contact. But like as it were to expand, these things go out of causal contact. So how do they continue to maintain the same temperatures when they're so far away from each other? Well, if inflation took the universe from when it was a uniform sort of temperature everywhere and expanded it into a macroscopic object right away, it could have taken it and then kind of like froze in the information, so that once it was all out of causal contact, it already had that information in it. And so it could keep the temperature that way. So that's another reason why inflation is something that would make the Big Bang and everything that we can see today make more sense without just saying it just happened by chance. So it was really interesting that you mentioned that, because that's essentially one of the things that we think happened. We don't know. So there's a lot of like speculation on whether it did or not, but it would make a lot of sense if it did. So yes.
So to sum up, I guess there are a couple of features of the universe, i.e. the flatness, which it doesn't necessarily have to be, or the fact that some particles who are too far apart to communicate in such a way that would explain having the same temperatures do.
Exactly.
And we kind of need a theory or an explanation to make sense of those. And one of those is inflation. One question about inflation is, if things are getting further apart and they're getting further apart faster, does that not imply that sort of conservation of energy has gone the wrong way? I.e. it's getting stronger and stronger and stronger as we go, as opposed to progressively weaker as other forces get in the way.
This is actually really interesting. You learn about conservation of energy, and so you take that and you say, well, the universe must be the same. However, that's not true in the universe, because we have also evolution through time. And so with that, you don't have to assume then that there's conservation of energy throughout. In fact, it isn't conserved. And so all the things that, you know, people get concerned about, it doesn't apply to the universe because, again, it's evolving with time. And so conservation of energy isn't necessarily something that you would apply to the universe as a whole.
I want to dig in here. That's so interesting. So conservation of energy, which I understand as energy basically maintains unless something gets in the way, unless another force speeds it up or slows it down, it will go constantly. You're saying that's not actually applying in the universe because there's this evolution over time element.
Yes, because it evolves through time. And so you can't apply conservation of energy throughout that entire period. I know there's a really cool blog post that Sean Carroll wrote about this. It was one of the things that I actually read in my undergrad, because I was also kind of wondering about that too. I'm like, hang on, like, why is energy not conserved? It doesn't make sense. But it turns out that, yeah, like, it doesn't, because in the universe, we have the whole universe evolving with time. And so you don't apply conservation of energy in the same way. And that breaks a lot of students in a way where they're like, wait, that means everything that I learned was a lie, but it actually isn't, because, again, the universe does evolve with time.
I think it's interesting. Whenever you look at the extreme macro or the extreme micro, and when I say extreme micro, I mean quantum mechanics, etc., the rules that apply in classical physics at normal scales seem to break apart. And then you have to do quite an elegant job of explaining why, no, the law hasn't been broken. It's just that there's this other variable that's running the show. Let's talk dark matter. So this is almost by definition confusing. To set some context before we dive in properly, I understand dark matter to be roughly, and please jump in where I veer off here, roughly speaking, one of three types of thing in the universe, with the other two being normal matter and dark energy. Is that right? And how do you think about the differences between them?
So essentially, in cosmology, to make it a little bit more complicated, in cosmology, actually, we take matter and basically we throw baryonic and dark matter all in together. So it's like matter, and then there's the cosmological constant, then there's radiation. Radiation today doesn't matter anymore, because this is where things get really cool. Today, you know, when you talk about the budget or the energy budget of the universe, you hear about dark energy, dark matter, and normal matter, the stuff that we're made up of. But you don't hear of radiation. Yet, if you were to rewind and turn back to the universe in its very early stages, radiation was actually the most dominant of them. It was the most dominant. However, what we have when the universe expands, you know, your object or whatever it is going to lose, it's going to dilute due to the volume. So it'll dilute by that much. So that's true for like matter alone. But remember, with photons, we also have this thing called redshift. So they lose an extra factor to energy because they suffer from energy loss as the universe expands, because it's kind of stretching apart their wavelength, which decreases their energy, or rather, excuse me, diluting in the universe. So it was diluting kind of like to the fourth power, whereas matter dilutes to the third power. It diluted so much that today it's pretty much insignificant.
So the idea is that there's a finite amount of radiation, but then as you expand the universe, it gets smaller as a proportion of the whole thing. And now you don't even need to take it into account when you're doing calculations because it's so insignificant. Whereas before, if you rewind the clock to a split second after the Big Bang happened, well, the whole thing looks like radiation.
Within the Big Bang, we got everything. So we got the radiation, we got cosmological constant, dark energy was there, matter was there too, but it was there in certain proportions. And with the size of the universe at the time, there was more radiation than there was anything else. However, you know, with the expansion of the universe, you are increasing the volume, but you still have the same amount of stuff in it. So we're rather diluting the radiation by the volume, but with an additional factor due to the expansion, because radiation also loses energy due to redshift. And so because of that, radiation became unimportant really fast. And then matter was left over, and matter was the dominant thing until eventually another little friend of ours, which we call the cosmological constant, which is the strangest of them all, it just hung out until it ended up becoming more important. Okay, so if I take a glass and I have it half full and I double its size, it's going to be a quarter full instead. Okay, I've decreased the density by that much. And that's what happens with matter. It happens with radiation too, but radiation is losing an extra factor due to the expansion of the universe because of redshift. But then you have the cosmological constant.
What is the cosmological constant here for those who aren't physicists?
So the cosmological constant is what we call dark energy. And dark energy is this weird stuff that we really don't understand. So we have less of an understanding of this than we do dark matter. And this is stuff that is causing the universe to expand at an accelerating rate. So it just stretches the universe apart faster and faster with the progression of time. And we really don't really understand what it is. We think it's a constant. And what that would mean is essentially this. So if I have two marbles per one cup, okay, And then I take that cup and I double it, then I'm going to have two marbles per two cups, which is, again, one marble per one cup. Okay, great. So that's what happens with matter. Cool. Let's put dark energy in. If I have two particles per one cup and then I expand the cup into like double its size, it seems as though it's increasing, but it's not. It's just chilling. You know, it's not diluting because of the volume. It's not affected by redshift. And so this stuff just stays constant. So that if it begins as, say, two particles per meter cubed, it's going to be two particles per meter cubed, even though the universe has gone and, say, grown by like a factor of 100. The density is still the same, which is like mind-blowing. It makes no sense whatsoever. That's like taking your one wine bottle, for example, right? And you wanted more of it. And you just take that wine bottle and expand it from a liter size to like 10 liters. And you'll have a literal 10-liter bottle of wine that's full. That makes no sense. Because like if I had a liter's worth of wine in a bottle, if I take that bottle and make it 10 liters big, I mean, if you could even do that in the first place, I would still have 1 liter in there of wine. But that's just not how dark energy works. And so it just remains constant with time. So all it really needed to do was wait around for the universe to take care of radiation and then matter. And it just came out the winner. And today we have 70% of the universe dominated by this stuff.
Yeah, it's hard to overestimate how strange that is. You know, you'd almost imagine for something's density to remain the same as the container gets bigger, you would require a constant input of that thing proportionate to the rate of the expansion.
Which is why people get confused and they're like, what happens to conservation of energy?
Is that the type of mystery when you say that you sort of need new physics to explain it? Is that a good example of an instance where that's true?
Yes, of course, because we actually don't know what dark energy is. So like, let's say that we're right and it's a cosmological constant, then okay, great. You know, our models work and basically like our current models will tell us a lot. But if we have more of an understanding of its nature and what its properties are, then it could bring us things that we don't understand now. It could bring us new physics, for example, because that would tell us things that we never knew in the beginning. When you have now a new thing that you never understood before, you have to rewrite certain things as well around it. For example, something as big as gravity, if gravity behaves differently than we expect, we'd have to rewrite almost everything because almost everything interacts with gravity. Whereas, let's say, you know, something like dark energy, I don't know what it could bring that would be applicable to us, but I don't know. That's just it. I don't know. I don't know what would be applicable in terms of applications. You have no idea like what it can bring. And so solving these mysteries is such a big deal. I'm going to explain to you why dark matter in particular is one that I'm very excited about.
This podcast is sponsored by BioBox Analytics. BioBox is a data analytics platform designed for scientists and clinicians working with next-generation sequencing data. Design and run bioinformatic pipelines on demand, generate publication-ready plots, and discover insights within your data from popular public databases. Free accounts will become available in early 2021, but space will be limited. Listeners of the Scientist podcast can be the first in line by joining the waitlist at biobox.io. Be the first to be notified when BioBox opens to the public.
So if you want to understand something like dark matter or dark energy, I think people are interested in how would you even go about that process? You know, I understand if you're an engineer and you want to build a certain type of bridge that hasn't been built before, it makes sense to me that there's certain kinds of maths you would run on different kinds of structures that haven't previously been attempted. But if you want to know more about dark matter or dark energy, where do you start? What's the first conversation you have?
Okay. So before I answer that question, I want to make sure that people know what dark matter and dark energy are. Dark energy, we just explained a little bit. It's this stuff we don't understand. It's stretching the universe apart faster and faster with time. And we have very little understanding of it aside from that. Dark matter is literally stuff that's just like us. So we're made up of particles. Okay, but there are forces that bring our particles together in the way that forms a hand or your phone or whatever, you know, your laptop, things like that, or even air, gas, you know? Whereas dark matter doesn't have those same interactions. So it doesn't interact with light, which is why we can't see it. We require, you know, some sort of radiation or something to be able to reflect light off of it for us to see it. That's why we can see anything now, is because everything reflects light. And so dark matter doesn't do that. It also doesn't interact with baryonic matter at all. It doesn't interact with us. So we have dark matter particles passing through us all the time. So this stuff is weird, but essentially what it is mass, just the same way that we are. except it has different interactions. So the one thing that I want to make sure that people understand is that dark matter and dark energy actually don't have any relation to each other aside from sharing the name dark or the word dark. It's just a word that is supposed to, I guess, explain sort of our ignorance and the fact that we can't see it. So a better word for it would be invisible. With dark matter, we still don't know what that is, but we are getting a better idea of what it's not, which does bring us closer to being able to solve the problem. How do we solve these problems or how do we even work on them? You know, with dark energy, for example, we see it because we observe the universe. When you look into the universe, you're looking back in time, because if I look at an object like, for example, Andromeda Galaxy, the Andromeda Galaxy is our closest big galactic neighbor. It's 2.5 million light years away from us. So when I look at it in the night sky today, I'm seeing it as it was 2.5 million years ago, because it took that light that's coming into my telescope or what I'm looking at, it took that light 2.5 million years to get here. And so the same is true if I look further back. And so when astronomers look further back and they kind of look at where the objects are kind of sitting, they notice that redshifts are actually increasing the further away that we go. And so that tells us that dark energy is there. So we can trace it by the weird things that we observe that don't make sense unless there's something weird going on. Similarly with dark matter, the way that we realize that it was there is because we're looking at galaxies. And let's say, for example, a disk galaxy like our own, that's a galaxy that has stars orbiting relatively a disk. So it's kind of similar to like a solar system where we have planets orbiting around one plane around the sun. And so that's the solar system. We live in it. That's kind of like a huge cosmic scale laboratory that we can test gravity in. And so we've done that. And what it tells us is that gravity, the force of gravity decreases the further away an object is. And with that, that also means that the speeds that those objects will have around their central object, which in our case is the sun. And so it will have slower speeds the further away it is from the center. So we expect the same thing when we look at galaxies. But, you know, Vera Rubin went with Kent Ford and they looked at Andromeda. They kind of plotted out the star speeds from the center moving outward as far as they could. They went out as far as you could. I think other astronomers went and they did high data or something. Or was that also Vera Rubin? I'm not sure. But they got a really good, what we call a rotation curve, basically a plot that shows you the speed of stars relative to their distance away from the center. So we expect to see what we see here and what we would see if you were to plot the planets, like say a curve that shows how fast they move relative to the distance from the sun, you would see that it decays with distance. And so you expect the same for a galaxy. But what they found with the Andromeda Galaxy was that it didn't matter how far away you were from the center of the galaxy. Stars had about the same speeds. They had the same velocities regardless. So it's like with the stuff that we can see, including black holes, and if we account for black holes and brown dwarfs, which are essentially failed stars, those we wouldn't be able to see as well because they weren't massive enough to ignite fusion in their cores. Even when we account for all that stuff, there's just not enough matter there, including gas. There's not enough matter there to be able to provide that much of a gravitational push or nudge to galaxies that are that far away. So galaxies like that should have essentially flown apart by now, but they haven't. That means something is holding it together, and there is something else that's also giving it this extra gravitational push. And that's how we know that dark matter is a thing.
I love that as an explanation, because I think it does quite well at summarizing what physics often is, which is we understand the nature of something. We understand how the processes should be working. And when they come apart slightly and they don't quite work how we expect, well, something's going on, right? And here it sounds like we have a missing variable. These galaxies should be flying apart. Why aren't they? Well, it's gravity. Well, hang on, but you need a certain amount of mass to produce a certain amount of gravity. Well, lo and behold, this is a mass. Speaking of dark matter being a mass, this might be a silly question. Can you weigh it? You know, it's passing through us all the time, but it doesn't seem to be the type of thing that you could capture in a bottle and weigh on a scale, but it's nonetheless providing mass. How does it provide mass? Because in my head, mass is provided by something that I can see or something that has particles and the common understanding of particles.
Mass is essentially something that an object is going to have. Gas particles have mass. We can't see them. Can you see the air right now? Sometimes you can. Like, for example, if it's a hot day, you can see sort of these weird like waves because of, I guess, you know, the turbulence in the air and whatnot, or you can see some radiation or whatever. But essentially, you can't see air. But that air has a mass too. Anything that's an object, aside from like, say, the photon, And then there's a particle called the gluon, which mediates the strong force. And assuming a graviton exists, the graviton would be the particle that would mediate the gravitational force. I'll talk about that in a second. But let's say these are the three particles that don't have mass. Everything else does. And that actually comes from interactions with the Higgs field. That's a little bit deeper. But essentially, everything that interacts with the Higgs field is what has a mass. It's a really cool sort of thing where like the photon was left out almost. And so it just doesn't interact with the Higgs field. But anything else, if you're a particle and you interact with the Higgs field, you have a mass. So in the universe, what that actually translates to, and this comes from Einstein's theory of general relativity. So now I'm going to address the graviton situation that I was just mentioning. Initially, we had this idea that, you know, gravity is a force, you know, like that's Newtonian gravity. But then Einstein came around and said, no, gravity is not a force. It's just essentially the way that space-time behaves around massive objects. What that is to say is that, so space-time is kind of like a fabric. And if I put something on it, kind of like if I put something on a blanket, it's going to create a little pot or a bowl, if you will. If I, say, put a golf ball on my bed, that's going to create a little ditch. But if I put a bowling ball on it, that'll be a lot deeper. And so that's kind of what you can picture the universe or the fabric of space-time, if you will, and how it behaves to masses. And so that's why when we have really massive objects, like, for example, a galaxy cluster, which is a cluster of like, say, thousands of gravitationally bound galaxies. And because there's so much of it, you're creating this huge dish or this huge bowl in the fabric of space-time, which we call like the gravitational potential well. And because it's so deep, you can add stuff into it. Like, so you have gas and you have stars that can never fly out because the bowl is so deep. That's essentially how we can, I guess, detect its mass.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, because the natural question otherwise is, if all we're missing is a variable here, such as dark matter, because we need something to be producing the mass, to produce the gravity, to keep these universes together, well, how do we know anything about it apart from the fact it has a certain amount of mass? Could it be exerting other kinds of forces or having other kinds of interactions with other kinds of particles? And if so, how would we know?
So this brings us to another topic, and this is kind of like what I do with dark matter. So for all the years that we've been studying this stuff, we've been trying to look for it in like the LHC, so the Large Hadron Collider. We have experiments in space trying to test for a type of dark matter as well. And we haven't found anything. And so that tells us that it probably either very weakly or doesn't at all interact with the stuff that we understand. And the stuff that we understand, we kind of put into this thing called the standard model. It's a standard model of particle physics, where that's essentially kind of like the periodic table is for chemistry, the standard model is for particles in particle physics. And so dark matter isn't in it. I wanted to make that clear. Dark matter isn't part of the standard model. So just the fact that there's an extra particle alone tells us there's new physics. In any case, what we do know is that we haven't seen any interactions with the standard model, because we would have detected it if we had. So it either extremely weakly interacts with the standard model or doesn't at all. But what if dark matter experiences different interactions than the ones that we can understand? And so there might be dark forces that we have not discovered yet. It's a model that I work on where dark matter does interact with other dark matter particles, but via a dark force that we've not yet discovered. Because a force has a particle that mediates it. For example, the electromagnetic force is actually mediated by the photon. So if we had a new dark force, it would be mediated by some other dark particle. Let's say it was a dark photon. Then maybe the dark photon is what interacts with the standard model. And so maybe that's how we could find it. And so that's kind of like what my work is working towards, is to figure out what these interactions are and whether there could be a dark force that is mediating these things that we don't know.
You know, listening to you, it's almost as if I'm getting memories of doing maths at school and trying to do simultaneous equations where it feels as if a variable is missing. You know, I've got five lines and six variables missing. And you're still always needing kind of another piece of the puzzle to make sense of the overall problem. But then that's the beauty, because then hence new physics, hence discovery. And then I imagine, and I'm projecting slightly here, but the physics changes to address an existing problem. Further problems that weren't initially obviously linked, but now you have this other tool, can become solvable. And that in some ways is why I think working in academia, but particularly in science and particularly in physics, is so obviously a contribution to the human project. Because you push the boundary just a little bit here, and that domino falls. And then all of a sudden, you have the ability to answer a whole bunch of other questions. Or if things get really exciting, you get to rip the textbook up. I've been reading actually at the moment about quantum physics. and how we understood photons. I mean, photons originally came about as kind of a halfway answer that no one really thought was right, but it just was nice for now because it made sense of the problem. But there was this presumption that something else would come along and solve it. And then that suggestion, the mis-suggestion of photons, light as particles as well as waves, rather than the previous conclusion that light was just waves, then was something that we could be testing. But until it's suggested, you can't test it. And this conversation has actually been, for me, such a good demonstration of how physics and working on problems that are difficult and mysterious is a contribution not just to those problems, but to the wider human project as well.
That was such a great way to put it. I just had to say that. That was such a great way to put it. Yes.
Well, Sophia, this has been so much fun. Thank you. Before we go, where can everyone find you?
I'm Astro Partigirl on Twitter, on Instagram. I also have my blog. I'm on TikTok as well, so I'll be putting videos up there as well. But I am going to make a YouTube channel, which you'll be able to find me talking about the universe, obviously, on. But if you just follow me on, say, Twitter or Instagram or follow my blog, you'll be able to get links to all of that stuff.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much. Everyone listening at home, that was Sophia Nasra. That was so much fun. You're not going to find a more accessible explanation of astrophysics and astroparticle physics than that. So Sophia, thank you again for coming on. And everyone at home, this has been the Scientist Podcast. And as always, we'll see you next week.